This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will be a question session reviewing multiple choice questions related to the female athlete, clinical trial design, and levels of evidence, which are three topics that we covered this past week on the podcast. So let's get right into it. We'll start with the female athlete. And the first question reads, which of the following is not considered to be a part of the constellation of the clinical entities known as the female athlete triad? And the choices are 1, decreased bone mineral density, 2, menstrual dysfunction, 3, low energy availability with an eating disorder, 4, low energy availability without an eating disorder, and 5, thyroid dysfunction. So thyroid dysfunction is not one of the clinical entities included in the female athlete triad, making 5 the correct answer to this question. But to quickly review, the female athlete triad was coined in 1992 by the American College of Sports Medicine as a complex disorder more prevalent in the adolescent and young female athlete population, including decreased bone mineral density, menstrual dysfunction, and low energy availability with or without a concomitant eating disorder. Treatment should involve a multidisciplinary approach, including psychological and nutritional counseling for eating behaviors and dietary management, reduction of training intensity to decrease risk of stress fractures, and initiating calcium and vitamin D supplements for osteoporosis. Nazem et al. Performed a systematic review of articles containing the female athlete triad, reviewing diagnosis via screening, during physical examinations, as well as laboratory and imaging evaluation for menstrual dysfunction, low energy availability, and low bone mineral density. They state that potential complications include possible infertility, decreased immune function, cardiovascular disease, and irreversible loss of bone mineral density. They concluded that prevention, early recognition, and a multidisciplinary treatment team with a focus on proper nutrition and natural return of menses is vital. Nativ et al. Reviewed the position of the American College of Sports Medicine regarding the female athlete triad, including screening for the triad at the pre-participation physical and discouragement of unhealthy weight loss practices. Essential members of the multidisciplinary treatment team include a healthcare professional, a registered dietitian, and a mental health practitioner. They endorse that the first aim of treatment for any triad component is to increase energy availability by increasing energy intake and reducing exercise energy expenditure. Moving on to the next question, all the following conditions are associated with the female athlete triad except, and the choices are 1, amenorrhea, 2, osteoporosis, 3, low LDL levels, 4, decreased immune function, and 5, insufficient caloric intake. So all the following listed are associated with the female athlete triad, except for low LDL cholesterol levels. In fact, these patients often have elevated levels of LDL due to the hypoestrogenism caused by menstrual dysfunction. So the correct answer to this question is 3, low LDL levels. But again, to quickly review, the female athlete triad is an interrelationship of menstrual dysfunction, i.e. amenorrhea or oligomenorrhea, low energy availability, that is insufficient caloric intake for demand with or without an eating disorder, and decreased bone mineral density. It is relatively common among young women participating in sports, and more recently it has been suggested that endothelial dysfunction also results due to an imbalance between vasodilating and vasoconstricting agents triggered from appropriate levels of nitric oxide on the microscopic level, which predisposes these women to atherosclerotic changes and increases their risk of cardiovascular disease in the future. More recently, it has been suggested that endothelial dysfunction also results due to an imbalance between vasodilating and vasoconstricting agents triggered from inappropriate levels of nitric oxide on the microscopic level, which predisposes these women to atherosclerotic changes and increases their risk of cardiovascular disease in the future. Matheson et al. Analyzed cases of 320 athletes with bone scan positive stress fractures, seen over 3.5 years, and assessed the results of conservative management. They found that conservative treatment of stress fractures in athletes is satisfactory in the majority of cases. Constantini et al. Evaluated the prevalence of vitamin D insufficiency and deficiency among young athletes and dancers. They found a higher rate of vitamin D insufficiency among participants who practice indoors during the winter months and in the presence of iron depletion. Yagi et al. Followed 230 runners participating in high school running teams for a total of 3 years to report occurrence of medial tibial stress syndrome and stress fracture. Predictors of medial tibial stress syndrome and stress fractures were investigated. The authors report a significant relationship between BMI, internal hip rotation angle, and medial tibial stress syndrome in females. Moving on to the next question. A 21-year-old female college athlete sustained a stress fracture of the fifth metatarsal 1 year ago, which was treated successfully with surgical stabilization and she returned to normal activities. She now has a tension-sided femoral neck fracture. Along with surgical fixation of the fracture, what is the next best step in management? And the choices are 1. Obtain a menstrual history. 2. Advise the athlete never to compete in high-level endurance sports again. 3. Obtain serum calcium levels. 4. Obtain a psychiatric consultation. And 5. Recommend changes in training intensity. So stress fractures can be seen in female athletes who develop the female athletic triad, including amenorrhea, osteoporosis, and eating disorders. Any female athlete with a history of stress fractures should undergo a workup for the disorder, and workup should include obtaining a menstrual history, obtaining a nutritional consultation, and obtaining a bone density. So the correct answer to this question is 1. Obtain a menstrual history. When properly counseled, these athletes may return to high endurance sports activities. Although these athletes may require a change in training intensity or psychiatric consultation, these would not be the next best step in management for this question. Psychiatric consultation may not be necessary unless an eating disorder has been diagnosed. Serum calcium levels are typically normal in these patients, and as a quick aside, tension-sided stress fractures of the femoral neck require surgical stabilization with internal fixation, as opposed to compression-sided stress fractures that can be treated with rest and non-surgical management. Moving on to the next question. An 18-year-old female Marine Corps recruit enters basic training. Her enlistment history and physical examination showed that she was an elite high school cross-country runner. What is her most significant risk factor for a femoral or pelvic stress fracture during basic training? And the choices are 1. Running mileage during the 2 months prior to basic training. 2. Self-rated fitness. 3. Running frequency during the 2 months prior to basic training. 4. No menstrual bleeding during the year prior to basic training. And 5. Race/ethnicity. So approximately 5% of female recruits incur a stress fracture during the 13 weeks of Marine Corps basic training. Approximately 40% of these were femoral or pelvic stress fractures that were more severe than in civilian athletes or male military recruits. Only women who reported no menses during the previous year had a greater likelihood of femoral or pelvic stress fractures than did women who reported 10 to 12 menses. So the correct answer to this question is 4. No menstrual bleeding during the year prior to basic training is her most significant risk factor for a femoral or pelvic stress fracture during basic training. Moving on to the next question. After normal menses has begun and in the absence of pregnancy, secondary amenorrhea is defined as which of the following? And the choices are 1. Increase in menstrual volume for 3 months. 2. Absence of menstrual bleeding for 6 months. 3. Excessive pain during menstrual bleeding for 2 months. 4. Absence of menstrual bleeding in the month following peak training intensity. And 5. Decrease in menstrual volume for 2 consecutive months. So secondary amenorrhea is defined as the absence of menstrual bleeding for 6 months or the absence of 3 to 6 consecutive menstrual cycles after normal menses has begun, making 2. Absence of menstrual bleeding for 6 months the correct answer to this question. The prevalence of amenorrhea among female athletes is estimated at 10 to 20% in women who exercise vigorously and as high as 40 to 66% in elite runners and professional ballet dancers. Moving on to the next question. Women athletes have a higher rate of ACL tears than male athletes in the same sport. While the cause is likely multifactorial, which of the following factors has been shown to contribute most significantly? And the choices are 1. ACL size. 2. Estrogen levels. 3. Neuromuscular coordination and training. 4. Intra-articular notch size. And 5. Valgus leg alignment. So there are many theories to account for the increased incidence of ACL tears in women athletes. While each of the answers may contribute, recent studies have shown that the difference in the level of neuromuscular training and coordination play the most significant role, making 3 the correct answer to this question. This is a potentially modifiable factor, and jump training and plyometric conditioning programs have been shown to decrease the rates of ACL injury in women. The articles by Griffin and Harmon are reviews by experts in ACL injury, which list all of the answers as contributing factors to increased ACL injury rates seen in women athletes. Of these, neuromuscular imbalances were felt to be both the most significant and of particular interest because they are potentially modifiable. The article by Zebis et al. States that neuromuscular training increased EMG activity for the medial hamstring muscles, thereby decreasing the risk of dynamic valgus. This observed neuromuscular adaptation during side cutting could potentially reduce the risk of non-contact ACL injury. And moving on to the final question for this topic, a 16-year-old gymnast is diagnosed with the female athletic triad. Which of the following treatments is the least appropriate management? And the choices are 1, calcium and vitamin D, 2, oral contraceptive pills, 3, reduced intensity of training, 4, bisphosphonates, and 5, psychological counseling. So bisphosphonates are the least appropriate step in management of the female athlete triad of the answer choices listed, making 4 the correct answer to this question. Again, the female athlete triad consists of eating disorders, amenorrhea, and osteoporosis, and treatment should consist of 1, consultation with a psychiatrist or psychologist for counseling to deal with self-esteem issues and eating disorders, 2, training should be limited until menses resume, and 3, supplemental vitamin D and calcium should be initiated, as well as consideration of oral contraceptive pills. Moving on to the next topic of clinical trial design, the first question reads, a study is proposed in which 50 patients with osteonecrosis of the knee are compared with 23 patients without osteonecrosis in terms of their alcohol consumption levels. This is an example of what type of study. And the choices are 1, case control, 2, cohort, 3, cross-sectional, 4, randomized, and 5, longitudinal. So in a case control study, all the subjects are selected based on whether they have or do not have the disease or outcome of interest. Case control studies are retrospective as they always look back to see how a certain risk factor may be different between the two groups. So the correct answer to this question is 1, case control study. The main aspect of a cross-sectional study is that it is designed to look at a representative sample of an entire population of interest at a single point in time. Longitudinal studies follow groups of subjects over a period of time. A cohort study follows a particular group in relation to an event, studying them at intervals in time and uses objective outcome criteria. In a randomized controlled study, subjects are divided randomly into control and experimental groups to balance both the known and unknown differences between the groups. Moving on to the next question, a clinical trial is underway for patients with wrist extensor tendonitis. One group of 100 patients are treated with short arm casting. Another group of 100 patients are treated with physical therapy. During analysis of the results, it becomes apparent that 30 patients in the physical therapy group did not complete the full course of physical therapy. Despite not completing a full course of physical therapy, these 30 patients were included in the physical therapy group for analysis. This analysis is an example of which of the following, and the choices are 1, per protocol, 2, crossover analysis, 3, intent to treat, 4, Bayesian analysis, and 5, effect size. So this is an example of intent to treat analysis, making 3 the correct answer to this question. The intent to treat approach aims to keep similar groups similar by not allowing for patient selection based on post-randomization outcomes, including failure to comply with the protocol. This type of analysis ensures the power of randomization so that important unknown variables that impact outcome are likely to be dispersed equally in each comparison group. Conversely, a per-protocol comparison in a clinical trial excludes patients who are not compliant with the protocol guidelines. Berger et al. In a Level 5 review discuss many of the principles beyond randomization that are critical for preserving the comparability of the different groups. They report that masking, allocation concealment, restrictions on the randomization, adjustment for prognostic variables, and the intent-to-treat approach to data analysis are important features of designing a good clinical trial. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, per protocol, excludes patients who are not compliant with the protocol guidelines. Answer 2, crossover studies involve switching patients between different arms of the study. Answer 4, Bayesian analysis is an analysis that starts with a particular probability of an event and incorporates new information to generate a revised probability, so the prior probability versus a posterior probability. And answer 5, effect size is the difference in outcome between the intervention group and the control group divided by some measure of the variability, typically the standard deviation. Moving on to the next question. A study was designed to measure the benefit of subacromial corticosteroid injections. Participants were randomized to methylprednisolone acetate 40 milligrams with lidocaine 1% or lidocaine 1% alone. The participants were not provided with information of their treatment allocation. The subacromial injection was prepared and administered by a single orthopedic surgeon. Results were collected by the orthopedic surgeon using clinical and patient satisfaction outcome scores at 6, 12, and 24 weeks. Which of the following would best describe this type of study? And the choices are 1, double-blinded, randomized, and controlled study, 2, single-blinded, randomized study, 3, retrospective study, 4, case control study, and 5, prospective cohort study. So the design of the study in the question would be best described as a single-blinded randomized study, making 2 the correct answer to this question. Single-blinded studies are designed to reduce bias in the treatment groups. Treatment allocation and results are withheld from the participants, but the experimenter will be in full possession of the results and outcomes. Experimenter's bias can influence the validity of the study, and so a double-blinded study in this scenario would have been a better study design. Cox et al. Looked at the design of clinical studies, and a triple-blinded randomized study is an extension of the double-blind design where the committee overseeing the response variables and data are not told of the participants' allocation within the study. Blinded studies intend to reduce observation bias associated with unblinded studies. So to quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, in double-blinded, randomized, and controlled studies, the doctor would not be aware of the treatment allocation or groups. In answer 3, retrospective studies would look back in time at 2 groups of patients treated with either methylprednisolone acetate 40 milligrams with lidocaine 1% or lidocaine 1% alone and compare the results. Answer 4, a case control trial would look at the effect of adding methylprednisolone acetate 40 milligrams with lidocaine 1% to a group of participants. And answer 5, prospective cohort study would not randomize and blind the patients of their treatment allocation. Moving on to the next question. A clinical study for lateral epicondylitis allocates one group to receive physical therapy for 4 weeks and another group a new oral medication for 4 weeks. Then the two groups immediately switch therapies with one another for the next 4 weeks. The half-life of the medication used in the study is 2 weeks. Which of the following best describes the bias that is present in this study design? And choices are 1, recall bias, 2, verification bias, 3, washout period bias, 4, detection bias, and 5, incorporation bias. So in a crossover study design, the washout period is the time between therapies receiving no therapy so that the effect of the first therapy is allowed to wear off. In this scenario, the medication's long half-life may continue to have effects after the first group receiving the medication has switched to the physical therapy treatment. So the correct answer to this question is 3, washout period bias, best describes the bias that is present in the study design described by the question. Verification bias occurs when results of a diagnostic test influence whether patients are assigned to a treatment group. Incorporation bias occurs when someone studies a diagnostic test that includes features of the target outcome. Recall bias occurs when patients who experience an adverse outcome have a different likelihood of recalling an exposure than others that don't have an adverse outcome. Detection bias occurs when one looks more carefully for an outcome in one specific group than the other group or groups. Moving on to the next question. A research study is initially designed as a high-quality randomized controlled trial. The study seeks to demonstrate a different clinical outcome with treatment A compared to treatment B for a specific disease. However, at the completion of the study, the investigators are only able to obtain 70% follow-up of patients. What level of evidence should be assigned to this study? And the choices are 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So a randomized clinical trial is a study design that is appropriate to demonstrate statistically that a clinical outcome in one treatment group is different from that in another treatment group. A properly designed randomized controlled trial that meets certain criteria is considered level 1 evidence. The AAOS Comprehensive Orthopedic Review and the article by Wright et al. States that randomized controlled trials that have less than 80% follow-up, no blinding, or improper randomization are lesser quality studies and qualify as level 2 evidence, making 2 the correct answer to this question. This is also criteria used by JBJS America for assigning levels of evidence to randomized controlled trials. The randomized controlled trial in this question has a 70% follow-up and therefore would be considered level 2 evidence. Level 2 evidence also includes prospective cohort studies whereby patient groups are separated non-randomly by exposure or treatment, with exposure occurring after the initiation of the study. Level 3 evidence includes retrospective cohort studies and case control studies whereby patient groups are separated by the current presence or absence of disease and examined for the prior exposure of interest. Level 4 evidence includes a case series of multiple patients with the same treatment but no control group or comparison group. Level 5 evidence includes a case report, expert opinion, or anecdotal evidence. Moving on to the next question. What is the primary purpose of utilizing a computer random number generator for patient randomization when designing a level 1 therapeutic controlled trial? And the choices are 1, to increase treatment effect, 2, to prevent selection bias, 3, to generate enough power, 4, to achieve statistical significance, and 5, to perform as-treated analysis. So a randomized controlled trial is the study design that can provide the most compelling evidence that the study treatment causes the expected effect on human health. The advantages of proper randomization include: it eliminates bias in treatment assignment, specifically selection bias and confounding. It facilitates blinding or masking of the identity of treatments from investigators, participants, and assessors. And it permits the use of probability theory to express the likelihood that any difference in outcome between treatment groups merely indicates chance. The reference by Poolman et al. Reviewed all JBJS articles from 2003 to 2004 and found that 31% of the studies used modified outcomes questionnaires and frequently did not describe how they modified the questionnaires. They also recommend that operating surgeons do not collect the outcome data in order to minimize bias. And the final question for this topic: a study is proposed in which two groups of patients are randomized to treatment with bisphosphonates or placebo. This is an example of what study type. And the choices are 1, crossover design trial, 2, parallel design trial, 3, cohort study, and 4, case series. So in a parallel design trial, participants are randomized to two or more groups, each of which receives a different treatment or intervention. For example, group A receives the drug and group B receives the placebo. This type of design allows for comparison between groups, making 2, parallel design trial, the correct answer to this question. In a crossover design clinical trial, both groups receive both interventions over a defined time period. For example, groups A and B both receive the drug as well as the placebo. This allows for within-participant comparisons. In a cohort study, patient groups are followed over time on the basis of having or not having received an exposure. Cohort studies are not randomized. In a case series, patients often receive a particular treatment and the outcomes are then examined. And moving to the final topic of this review session, levels of evidence, the first question reads: in the study by Mosley et al., published in the New England Journal of Medicine, 180 patients with knee osteoarthritis were randomly assigned by a sealed envelope to receive arthroscopic debridement, arthroscopic lavage, or placebo surgery. Outcomes were assessed by blinded evaluators at several points over a 2-year period with the use of 5 self-reported pain and function scores. There was a greater than 90% follow-up in the study. This study is best described as having which level of evidence? And the choices are 1, therapeutic study with an evidence level of 1, 2, therapeutic study with an evidence level of 2, 3, a diagnostic study with an evidence level of 1, 4, diagnostic study with an evidence level of 2, and 5, prognostic study with an evidence level of 1. So therapeutic studies investigate the results of treatment. Level 1 evidence includes randomized controlled trial with statistically significant difference or no statistically significant difference but narrow confidence intervals. So the correct answer to this question is 1. This is a therapeutic study and it is an evidence level of 1. A level 2 therapeutic study would include a lesser quality randomized controlled trial, for example, less than 80% follow-up, no blinding, or improper randomization. A non-randomized prospective cohort study that compares the results of treatment or systematic reviews of level 2 studies or level 1 studies with heterogeneous results would also be considered a level 2 study. Prognostic studies investigate the effect of a patient characteristic on the outcome of disease, and diagnostic studies investigate the efficacy of a diagnostic test. Moving on to the next question. A prospective study is performed at a single institution to analyze the potential differences in treating intertrochanteric hip fractures with a plate/screw device versus an intramedullary device. No specific randomization is performed because an equal number of surgeons have preferences for the use of one of these devices, and they are allowed to continue their preferred method. Hip-specific and general health-related outcome measures are used. An excellent follow-up rate of 85% of the patients at 2 years is accomplished, and there appears to be results that favor the intramedullary device, but the confidence intervals are wide. This study would be considered to carry what level of evidence? And the choices are 1-1, 2-2, 3-3, 4-4, and 5-5. So this is a prospective comparative study, but is not randomized or blinded, and is therefore a level 2 therapeutic study. Again, to qualify as a level 1, it would need to be a high-quality, randomized trial with narrow confidence intervals, regardless of a significant difference or no difference in outcomes. Level 3 would be a case control study or retrospective comparisons, level 4 is a case series, and level 5 is an expert opinion. Moving on to the next question. Currently, what is the most common clinical study type in the orthopedic literature? And the choices are 1, level 1, which is prospective and a randomized trial, 2, level 2, which is a cohort trial, 3, level 3, which is a retrospective case control, 4, level 4, which is retrospective case series, and 5, level 5, which is an expert opinion. So although a recent push for prospective, randomized trials has been advocated by multiple orthopedic journals, many studies published continue to be of level 4 evidence, which is, of course, a retrospective case series. Case series represented 64% of all studies reviewed by Friedman and Associates in 2001 from the British and American volumes of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and from Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research. Obremski and Associates published that 58.1% of all studies from 9 orthopedic journals were level 4 evidence. Further investigation of more current trends is likely warranted with the current emphasis on publishing higher level of evidence studies in orthopedic journals. Moving on to the next question. Which of the following study designs represents a level 3 evidence study? And the choices are 1, prospective randomized controlled trial, 2, retrospective case control study, 3, retrospective case series, 4, prospective cohort study, and 5, expert opinion. So the practice of evidence-based medicine means integrating individual clinical expertise with the best available external clinical evidence from systematic research. Therapeutic study hierarchy of evidence has been established to better analyze studies in a reproducible fashion. Again, level 1 studies include well-designed randomized controlled prospective studies. Level 2 include lower quality designed prospective randomized controlled trials as well as prospective cohort studies. Level 3 includes retrospective cohort studies and case control studies. So the correct answer to this question is 2. A level 3 study is a retrospective case control study. And just to finish this off, a level 4 study includes case series, and level 5 includes case reports, expert opinion, and personal observation. Moving on to the next question. An orthopedic resident wants to answer a focused research question of whether mobile-bearing knee arthroplasty has superior functional outcomes compared to fixed-bearing knee arthroplasty. The resident mathematically combines the results from multiple retrospective cohort studies following quality of reporting meta-analyses guidelines. What is the highest level of evidence that this meta-analysis can achieve? And the choices are level 1, level 2, level 3, level 4, and level 5. So the level of evidence assigned to a meta-analysis is based on the lowest level of evidence of the included studies. And so in this case, the studies included in the meta-analysis were retrospective cohort studies. So the correct answer to this question is 3, level 3. Again, a meta-analysis is a systematic review that combines the results of multiple studies to answer a focused clinical question. Moving on to the next question. A therapeutic study presents a systematic review of 15 high-quality randomized controlled trials with homogeneous results. What level of evidence is this considered? And the choices are 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So a systematic review of high-quality clinical trials is considered a level 1 study, making 1 the correct answer to this question. Again, a systematic review is a powerful tool used to identify, evaluate, and appraise all high-quality research related to a specific question. Systematic reviews, in contrast to most narrative review articles, adhere to strict scientific design by following 8 steps. 1. Defining a question and developing inclusion criteria. 2. Searching for studies. 3. Selecting studies and collecting data. 4. Assessing risk of bias. 5. Data analysis and meta-analyses. 6, addressing biases, 7, presenting results, and 8, interpreting results and drawing conclusions. When the results from the systematic review are homogeneous, which is less variability between studies than would be expected by chance, the data from a systematic review can be combined into a meta-analysis. And moving on to the final question for this topic, a surgeon decides to report outcomes for a new surgical procedure that he has performed on 10 patients who have a rare type of arthritis. He provides data on the functional and subjective patient outcomes. This type of study design is best described as a, and the choices are 1, case series, 2, case control study, 3, cohort study, and 4, randomized clinical trial. So the type of study design in which a series of cases is presented with outcomes without a control population or comparison group is known as a case series, making 1 the correct answer to this question. This type of study design, although frequently seen in orthopedic literature, provides the lowest level of evidence. There is no control group, and the population is usually poorly defined. This type of study can be helpful as a starting point for further analysis. A randomized trial provides the highest level of evidence, as we mentioned in medical research, featuring a comparison group and a randomized and usually blinded placement of subjects into study groups. In case control studies, cases are compared to a control group. The control group has not been randomized, but may be a naturally occurring group of subjects who have not had the same exposure or intervention as the case group. A cohort study can be retrospective or prospective and usually looks at a large group of people over time to assess exposures and incidence of disease. That's all for this question review session about the female athlete, clinical trial design, and levels of evidence. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.